Welcome, everyone. This is Diana Oblinger, President of EDUCAUSE, and you're participating in Day 3 of the 2013 EDUCAUSE Sprint. Now, the Sprint is an intense online global community event with colleagues participating from every state in the U.S., including Puerto Rico, and 35 other countries. Yesterday, we had participants from as far away as Australia, Chile, and the Netherlands, and as Jim Jorstadt said in the chat earlier, it's good to see so many sites and people connected, and our theme is about the connected age, so we'll talk more about that. As you probably know, many of you have said this is your third day. The Sprint focuses on a hot topic over 3 days, and we try to do that through a variety of mechanisms, through webinars, blogs, idea scale voting, polls, and social media. And as you probably know, there's a lot of good information on the Sprint website, so I hope you will visit that. Now, this week we've been exploring how large-scale online programs, including MOOCs, are impacting how we think about IT, even what it means to be a college or university. And on day one, we started out talking about MOOCs and how they might be a harbinger of change for the connected age. On day two, we explored how technology can impact pedagogy and the teaching and learning experience. And today's topic is creating the IT architecture for the connected age. And we're going to explore the complex infrastructure that's required to support the connected age. Now, the EDUCAUSE 2013 Sprint is sponsored by Acquia and Blink Reaction, and they help colleges and universities create sophisticated knowledge management platforms with Drupal to improve the user experience, security, performance, and scalability. We want to thank our sponsors today. Now, since many of you have been here the last couple of days, you're probably familiar with the interface for our webinar, and we hope you will make this a very interactive day. But five quick notes about the interface. On the left-hand side, there's a chat box that allows you to share comments and share resources. So if you've got a URL or something you want to share with others, please post it there. You'll notice on the lower right-hand corner, there's a separate chat box where you can enter your questions for the speakers. And we'll be watching that lower right-hand box as we go through the afternoon collecting your questions. You'll also notice that at the bottom of the screen, there's an open caption box, which is a new accessibility feature. And you can change the font size displayed in the chat, question, or caption boxes by clicking on the lines to the right or left of the chat or the up and down arrows. We also have a visual recorder working behind the scenes, and during the question and answer periods, as well as at the end of the session, you'll see a visual representation of our discussion. You'll be able to see the whole visual recording along with a time-lapse movie that we'll post on the Sprint website later on today. And if you experience any technical or audio difficulties, there's a box there that's called Technical Help. So if you've got a need for any kind of assistance, please type it in and we'll get right back to you. And many of you have already seen we've got a back channel going, and if you want to tweet, please use the hashtag EDUSprint. And again, the session and the recording will be available later on today on the Sprint website. And to start, we'd like to ask you all a question. And that is, what's the most important insight that you've gained from the Sprint so far? And we'll post a quick poll, and you can give us your reaction to what you think has been the most important insight so far. So while you're doing that, let me turn to today's webinar. And of course, as you well know, the infrastructure necessary for the connected age is complex. It includes technologies, processes, management strategies, and governance structures. Of course, you also know that today's colleges and universities are under pressure to deliver more value, contain costs, and expand into new areas, whether it's research, online learning, analytics, or a campus abroad. And all of those activities depend in one way or another on IT. And when we say IT, it isn't just the physical infrastructure. It's the stuff our students and faculty bring, the bring your own device, or really more about bring your own everything. And the entire environment around us also has to take into count the services and human expertise required to make everything work. As IT professionals, you also know that IT needs to be agile and innovative, while at the same time being solid and reliable. So we'll be asking questions about what kinds of investments allow IT to be agile, and how we should be thinking about services, identity, security, provisioning, and support. And in the connected age, where everything is connected, IT and its support might come from inside the institution as well as outside the institution, because the models are no longer limited to commercial providers offering services. We're seeing more co-sourcing, community sourcing, and collaborative procurement. But of course, to provide the right services, we first have to understand the evolution of the physical campus and the kind of mashup of services our students, faculty, and staff need. And while MOOCs are one reason we're challenging our assumptions about technology, architecture, and services, it is the catalyst that brings us to the discussion today. So let me tell you a little bit about our speakers. First, Tracy Futhi. Tracy is the Vice President for Information Technology and Chief Information Officer at Duke University. Since 2002, Tracy's presided over Duke's information technology endeavors. She's led programs that I'm sure you've all heard about, such as the Duke Digital Initiative, which uses iPods and iTunes. She spent 17 years at Carnegie Mellon University prior to joining Duke, and at Carnegie Mellon, Tracy's career spanned the entire range of IT from computer consultant to CIO. Tracy is a past board member for Internet2 and serves on industry advisory councils for Fortune 100 technology companies. We have Tracy Schroeder joining us as well. Tracy joined Boston University as Vice President of Information Services and Technology in July of 2009. And her breadth of experience at BU illustrates, I think, the challenges people in IT face. Implementing new technology, implementing governance structures, IT service management practices, information systems for administrative units, and a variety of technology upgrades. Before joining Boston University, Tracy led the Information Technology Services Department at the University of San Francisco. She's served the IT profession through a variety of roles, such as the president of the Association of Jesuit Colleges and Universities Conference on IT Management. And our third presenter is Ethan Benetton, who's the Vice President and Chief Information Officer and Chief Strategy Officer at Merrill Hurst University in Portland, Oregon. He's previously held positions at Reed College, Duquesne University, University of Pittsburgh, and at Brookhaven National Laboratory. He's worked in strategy, organizational development, and planning for large-scale trends in technology, and he also regularly gives back to the community. He's published, presented, and served on higher education in a variety of different roles, including leading professional development programs on advisory groups, and I'm pleased to say he's been a department editor for EDUCAUSE Review as well. So I appreciate all three of you spending your time with us today, and Tracy Futhi, why don't we begin with you?
Great. Thanks, Diana. It's great to be here and good to be a part of this panel and discussion. I'll open things up fairly quickly with a high-level overview of some of the facets and implications of being in that connected age, and a couple of dives in throughout that process for how we design services or how we should think about infrastructure as a result. So just to jump on things right away, I think, as Diana has pointed out, there are a lot of pressures that we're facing right now. Two that are really obvious and in our faces every day are the conflicting pressures to both reduce costs and make sure we've got access anytime, anywhere for everybody in the community. Then we have a series of what I would describe, and by far these aren't the only pressures on the universities, by the way, but a series of what I'd describe as maybe opportunities, but also threats. We've got mobile internet and consumer technologies, which really increase the breadth and the opportunity for our community. Likewise, global collaboration allows our faculty and our students to work internationally. Those are great opportunities, but also add some difficulty to the environment we have to provide. We have issues that relate to international aspects. The whole world is flat premise. We've got a much bigger base now we need to think about and contend with, and bigger expectations and footprint for our services and technologies. And finally, there's an increasing expectation that we need to help find ways to serve the underserved and extend beyond. And much of the discussion around MOOCs is at least one way to do that and fulfill our service missions. And as I think about these things together, the result is really sort of new approaches and new programs that we're all thinking about. MOOCs clearly is a big part of that. And again, you know, the underserved world is a component. Obviously, this past year, if anyone had to describe it in IT terms for universities, it would have been the year of the MOOC. But that's really only part of the story. I think the whole notion of online classes that have been around, certainly not forever, but for quite a long time, and have had much less fanfare and attention, are just as important, I think, to the services we deliver and the evolution of our campuses. But now the technology and the popularity of MOOCs have really enabled some new opportunities for merging and evolving and integrating those new services, those new approaches with our traditional campus. So let me jump into things perhaps with a little bit of a poll and ask folks where they would describe themselves, their campus, in terms of how far along. And these are questions that range from exploring to delivering and encompass online, MOOC, or both. So we're seeing some good distribution, lots of, so far, delivery, it looks like, of flipped and hybrid courses, and then a pretty even split, it looks like, right now, among others, although we're starting to get some more exploration and delivery of MOOCs. I think this goes to the point I was making that online courses or flipped or hybrid courses are something that are a little bit more tried and true in kind of the big scheme of things for our universities and where we are now. It looks like things have slowed down on the poll. Clearly a lot of delivery of hybrid and MOOC and moving into or exploring the others. So beyond those, the online and MOOC world, I think the other thing that's relevant to talk about in terms of a connected environment are the implications for the evolution of today's universities and how we address those pressures of the international aspects, the service and brand we deliver internationally. And so increasingly, I think campuses are seeing a fair amount of global expansion, whether that's physical campuses themselves or not, varies by the institution. But in some ways, this is, again, something that's been around forever but has evolved. We've always, or many of us would think of our campuses as always having had study abroad programs where we send our students there, right, to some there for a period of time. And then over the last maybe decade or so, we've increasingly had a slightly different approach to internationalization where we focus on bringing, you know, students from there here, right, and bringing them to our traditional campuses. And so now, in a sense, we've got what I would describe as, at least increasingly from universities, a focus of, you know, now we are there, right, and the idea of physical campuses. So let's jump to another poll and ask where you all see yourselves. And here we've got seven choices, and you can pick multiple choices here in this list. Basically check all or any of these that reflect what your campus approach and the extent to your international activities includes. Again, emphasizing that notion of we've always had, so to speak, study abroad programs. We seem to have a high percentage of people demonstrating that here in the poll. But also, as you see, a big emphasis on recruiting international students, and growing about, looks like about a third from this group at least, is involved in international service programs with students and international faculty research. The international campuses are still somewhat small, but you see we've got about 5% as non-degree granting, and about 15% looks like are showing that they have some degree granting activity going on internationally. Interesting, again, to see where everyone stands in this domain, and it's much more than than just MOOCs. And clearly, I should point out this list is not exhaustive, but it does, I think, give a representative and indicative look at what all people are doing internationally. So what's a CIO to do, right? You've got online courses, they're keeping you crazy busy. You've got MOOCs, and they're changing every day you wake up. There's a new headline about something different. And you've got people on campus introducing international programs. What I've described here are what I think are three important considerations for the CIO. The first is about the IT infrastructure, and this is, you know, how do we build a common and extensible infrastructure? The second is when we think about the services, how do we make sure we design the services that span these different kinds of activities and use cases and the new facets of the university, not just that focus on one or the other, not with a focus on MOOC different from a focus on online or even different from a focus on on-premises campus courses. And then the third one, perhaps even most interesting among those, is how do we think about the new emerging issues outside of our traditional IT systems and implications? In particular, spending a lot of time thinking about what IT will make possible and for the campus, even the traditional campus, and how do we be sure we have a seat at the table to help participate in and guide those discussions? So in a sense, this is, you know, the first one about IT infrastructure. It's the old real estate location, location, location thing. But here the location is a little different. The first location I would describe is the physical connectivity. This is, I think, pretty obvious, but how do we get system access there, right? So IT, in a sense, is the campus. It's no longer the physical campus. So IT becomes the equivalent of the geography, the place where people came to. And so now we're really going to have to worry a lot more and spend a lot of attention on end-to-end services and performance, not just the campus wireless network or the campus local area network, but how do I make sure my video conference to Beijing is really going to happen and not have latency and jitter that creates a bad experience for the students in the class. The second location aspect piece, I think, relates to the physical campus no longer not being the only thing, but it's not even at the core anymore. How do we deal with and how do we remain attentive to the needs to think about upgrades and upgrade scheduling and outages when we've got a 24/7 world, but not just from our own time zone, from basically any or every time zone in the world? This becomes a quite interesting challenge, but one that is really essential as we think about both online courses where people are studying and taking, doing materials, doing work anytime from any location, and also our physical campuses. There's also, I think, an important issue on this front that relates to cloud services and provisioning in the cloud. And then beyond provisioning through the cloud, the idea of how do we provision based on not only who you are, where you are, but what you're doing. Some of the tools we're using here are some of the internet tools, not just for authentication, but also something like Grouper for really sophisticated management of groups. We've created some of our own tools, something we call toolkits that lets us provision for an entire class across multiple tools. So provision all at once, everything from the Sakai site to the WordPress ability to the mailing list to you name it, right? 20 or 30 different things a student might need access to. And then the other thing I have in here that I reference is what I call activity streams, which I think of as a little bit of super glue. As we move to this idea that people are anywhere and everywhere, and we've got to move away from just synchronous services to asynchronous services, there becomes this challenge of how do we connect people back together. And so the ability to have sort of an activity stream that tells me in Sakai that someone in my same class did something in WordPress and connect those together, I think, becomes increasingly important for the population we're talking about and in order to enable that kind of connected age. All throughout those, as it relates to infrastructure, we've got to make sure that, you know, we have repeatable approaches and ways to extend things, not one-offs. So thinking about, for example, something like virtual machines, how do they relate to activities on the campus, virtual desktop interaction, labs, but also travelers, and how do we enable those throughout? If we turn from architecture to services, I think the key here is that they are flexible, extensible, and efficient, but linked together at the same time. And so here what I would describe as flexible very quickly, I would really focus on a range of options and uses. So as we think about specific services, having multiple ways to use those and to evolve them over time. In terms of extensibility, I've already mentioned synchronous and asynchronous video. That's extremely important, especially as we think about international collaboration and, again, keeping people connected. Presence, who's online now, who can help me now, wherever they might be. Again, this even enables aspects, again, of community around support. So we can support much of it from the IT environment, but we may not have to if there are other people who are available and accessible. When I think further about some of these services, and most of the ones I've described here are mostly around the video, around the collaboration, but certainly this applies to everything. How do we think about access to video materials and the ability to give people sort of a mix-and-match capability of their materials across courses? How do we disaggregate those course materials, create a searchable repository that's not only used by teachers but also by learners so that they can search for not just what this instructor wanted them to know about a particular concept, but what might have been taught last year in a different course? Again, all these things need to be repeatable, and the better off if they're fairly extensible across the different activities and the facets of use, from international to online and MOOC. So if we shift from infrastructure and services and think about those sort of non-traditional emerging IT issues, I have up here a quote by Michael Crow, who's the president at Arizona State University. And what I would focus on here is in the second sentence. I mean, it's a great quote overall, but in the second sentence, he talks about the implication has altered all the assumptions about, and you know, he has a list of several things, but one of the pieces is the structure of the learning community. And so here is where I think there is a really important lesson and caution for us to take away about our role as it relates to the sort of not traditionally IT issues in supporting the campus and imagining how we structure the campus experience. From the standpoint of the campus itself, we all know, you know, it's now wherever I am, whether that's on the physical campus, any classroom, any library, any location. The community is no longer what it once was, right? Joining a university used to be a place to go. You join a physical community. Through that physical location and community, you'd unlock for you information, conversations. We'd have an environment where we could really assess learning, have dialogue. These things all were related to the physical campus, and that's just gone now, right? They're no longer, a campus is no longer, in this case, community is no longer a physical place. Another piece I think that's really important for us to focus on is around the analytics, the big data. It's no longer the case that I need to teach my entire life and learn after 30 years of teaching, you know, what were some of the best approaches. In a 10-week MOOC course, I get more data than I might get in my entire lifetime. Those become important IT issues for us to be involved in and participating in with our faculty and our researchers. Likewise, there are, I think, some important system interaction issues. These relate in many ways from the pressure of the consumer technologies, and these are a little different from some of the others I've noted here, but just as important for us to pay attention to as IT leaders. And that is this idea in the future that while we'll still need big, you know, ERP systems, the reality is we're going to really need to disaggregate those into little slices of what are the five most important tasks a faculty member needs to do, and those become little apps, right? So it really changes vastly the kinds of things we need to think about in terms of how we deliver the IT environment. If we think a little bit about some of the new applications and technologies and how they impact the future of the campus experience, I would say I see two really powerful places where we need to pay attention. One relates to physical constraints. Our campuses have all made, you know, 50-year, 100-year investments in buildings, right? And that's juxtaposed against internet time, where things are changing every minute. And the reality now with MOOCs is that we're the campus and the delivery of courses and the learning is being delivered in internet time. And so we've got physical facilities with these huge lecture halls that we may not need now. We certainly won't need sometime in the future. How many of these should we continue to build, and what do we do with the ones we have? I think there's another piece here around sort of the organizing paradigm of how do we think about the campus. And again, these go to the core of the campus itself. We've done a dozen or so MOOCs at Duke in this last year, and not a single one has been paced equivalent to the traditional classroom. Right? We haven't had 13 weeks long, right, X times a week. We've had these 8 weeks, 6 weeks. No one really views the semester as anything but, I believe, an artificial constraint that says, here's how many weeks you have to teach, here's how many contact hours you have. And so really the question becomes, how does technology let us separate out that experience? And then, more importantly, what does that do to our campus when we all of a sudden don't have these nice, evenly spaced activities? So these are some of the things I see as beyond the traditional IT issues, not the least of which is the organizational structure and thinking about online as an integral part of what we do on campus, not as a separate, the online czar sits over there and does very different things. So to draw it all together, so to speak, a little bit, we've got the traditional campus, we've got online learning, and then we have global activities. In many ways, I talked about common IT infrastructure and services. We really need, if we can focus on how we can use common infrastructure and services to connect the online and the global with the campus, then what we can do is use the online and global as the different set of uses that inform the need to make changes to the traditional campus approaches. And through that, we can sort of experiment in ways that don't keep us tied down by existing campus constraints and culture that sometimes can be resistant to change. And we have experiences that we can actually cite in other areas that are successful and bring that as a way to help drive the campus to innovate and try things in different ways. So with that, Diana, let me stop and see where we want to go next.
I would like to ask you about to talk a little bit more about how you think about the campus. You've raised this notion that it's local, it's global, it's physical, it's virtual. You also raised a question about sort of the organizing paradigm and questions about, is a semester 16 weeks, 4 weeks, all of those things. What kinds of specific issues are you wrestling with at Duke, for example? And I'll give you an example from yesterday's conversation. Eric Grimson from MIT indicated that they're completely rethinking space because even dormitories need virtual space for classes and other kinds of things. So thinking a bit outside of IT, but with those IT implications, what are some of the things that you're really wrestling with? Is it dorms? Is it libraries? Classrooms?
I think it is all of those plus the academic calendar, right? Do we have 16-week terms, 14-week terms, whatever your answer is? The reality is our campuses are organized for a very periodic pacing of students, whether that's the classroom, whether that's the dormitory, whether that's the scheduling of hours, right? And that is completely thrown on its head. I think the biggest thing I think we're probably all contending with is, or maybe faced to contend with, is a lack of recognition about how quickly this will change. Most people that I encounter absolutely agree that on two things. One, that universities, the residential campus experience, I don't know if this is everywhere, but at many of our campuses, won't completely go away, right? There's still a need for the residential campus experience, and there's huge value in it. So most people agree on that, and most people agree on the fact at the same time that online courses are changing things. What I think people are going to have to grapple with is the pace of that, and I think most people think we will have much more time to change that than anyone in the corporate world had to change had the time and leisure to change when they were faced with a big transformational hit on the traditional approach.
So picking up on your comment about pace of change, one of the ways of increasing or perhaps slowing down the pace of change is for people to understand what's going on. And we used to use a term about IT literacy or information fluency with many of our students. And I guess I'm wondering whether you've got any particular advice for us, either for working with students, working with our peers, or developing IT savvy administrators. All this is going on so quickly, it's hard enough to keep track of it in IT. How do we do that with other groups?
Yeah, well, so one of the things we've been trying to do with the student group is introduce much more of an innovative culture, much more of an understanding that students will help to create and build apps or websites or videos that help to demonstrate a topic in a course that they thought they can explain better than the instructor, right? Really trying to bring the students into the process in a more interactive way. So we launched that program about a year ago, mostly aimed at students and promoting more of a culture of innovation. When it comes to faculty, it's really for us been most effective to have faculty talking to other faculty and describing their experience, describing why at the same time their work on a MOOC took more effort than they ever could have imagined. They might not have started it if they had known before, but having now done it, they would absolutely do it again, right? And so that sounds contradictory, but it really isn't. And they really come out of it not only charged about their course and their experience, but really thinking about teaching in a much more invigorating way. And at least for our campus, it's created a fantastic dialogue among the faculty about teaching and learning. And IT is at the table, and I haven't seen that in my entire career, that we're really at the table and at the center of the table in that way, certainly around the edges in the past, but here right in the middle of the discussion. So I think it's all very exciting.
Absolutely. And I think we've fought for so many years to be at the table. Your comment that being put at the center of the table is a real step forward. So, Tracy, thank you. I want to turn and ask Tracy Schroeder to share some thoughts with us around her ideas for how we use infrastructure as a foundation for the future. Tracy?
Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks to EDUCAUSE for inviting me to join in what is a very exciting and useful, I think, discussion right now as we all grapple with what we need to do to enable our institutions to move forward in a time of a lot of uncertainty. And when we feel, I often feel like we're trying to solve an equation with too many unknowns. And when I look around and say, so where can I start? What should we be doing first? When I thought about what I would talk about today, I ended up zeroing in on some actual projects and initiatives that we have going on here at BU that I really see as foundational initiatives that will enable us to have the flexibility and capability to support our institution moving forward. And so briefly, I'm going to talk about our strategic planning process that's been underway for over a year now that is a context and framework for everything we're doing, including the other four initiatives below. Talk a little bit about identity and access management, which is, I think, the center of the spider for provisioning and managing access to services for our community in this increasingly dynamic environment. Talk a bit about our academic data warehouse initiative to support current and major future analytical requirements, including on a massive scale. How we're thinking about the potential future of our student information systems, how that pertains to massive scale as well, and what we're doing in the digital learning area. So with regard to technology planning, this is a new experience for the BU community. It's the first IT strategic plan to have been completed here, and it's been, as a result, a fairly extensive process of discussion with a focus on developing a shared vision of the future and what it will take to get there. One might say, well, of course, Tracy, that's vanilla and motherhood and apple pie. We all know we need to do this in IT. But it's interesting to note how many folks out in the world today say, well, that with the pace of change in IT, strategic plans, especially on a time frame of 3 to 5 years, are not useful, not feasible to produce, and the change is too rapid. But I felt, and I think my community at this point is agreeing with me, that coming off of a large number of really administratively heavy information systems projects and some basic infrastructure projects, that we needed to address a lot of pent-up demand and establish some guideposts around how we were going to move forward with new challenges. So despite the fact that we were doing this planning effort in parallel with a Council on Educational Technology and Learning Innovation, which I was fortunate enough to serve on, and there were certainly other unknowns and topics in flux, it was still important to move forward with the conversation and to step-by-step put together drafts and goals to establish some shared framework and language for talking about how we move forward. And so the green bar here you see on the slide, we started back in June of 2012. The green bar is July 2013 through October 2013. And I am optimistic that we'll get through the roadshows in the early portion of the fall and to approval of our plan later this semester. So one of the founding initiatives in the plan is identity and access management. And if we could just start by taking a little sense of the group as to where you all are at with regard to identity and access management. And by this, I mean directory services, say Active Directory, LDAP, authentication, including single sign-on, acknowledging that there are varying degrees of single sign-on, and federated identity, things like In Common and Shibboleth, to allow not only seamless access to resources on your campus, but to resources on colleagues' campuses, or other third parties. Interested to see where folks are at. So, yeah, it looks like a number of you feel you're all set. That's impressive. But also a fair number executing projects or planning projects. Still filling up there. Okay. So now, as a little brief preface, I want to assure you this is not going to be a technical discussion, but whoa, Nelly, here's the current BU Identity and Access Management architecture. I'm not going to talk about this in terms of technical detail, but I have sometimes said to folks in my campus community clients that the architecture diagram for this current service will make your eyes roll back in your head. And this is actually a fairly high-level view of what we have. BU was early to develop a customized set of directories and middleware for single sign-on, and this infrastructure has been adapted incrementally over many years, resulting in a complex and sometimes tangled web of solutions to specific problems rather than a holistic system that meets current needs and is readily adapted for foreseeable future use cases. So we see the future as a time when a core competency of central IT needs to be rapid provisioning of new services, decommissioning of services that are no longer relevant, moving us towards a plug-and-play kind of environment, providing the right access to the right people easily, and this has to be provided efficiently. So we're moving towards, this is our target state, and with the goal and principles to modernize and simplify our identity and access infrastructure to provide that type of agility as well as reduce the cost of the complexity and, frankly, instability occasionally with the age of certain components and complexity of them associated with our current environment. So we are generally driving towards common, supported, and standards-based infrastructure that will allow us to get closer to that plug-and-play type reality. The analysis and planning effort is non-trivial, and it's taken us 2 years to really understand, document our current environment, design the future state, and develop a roadmap for getting there. And a big part of the challenge for us has been documenting not only how the infrastructure is configured, but the business logic behind it, and affirming the business area ownership of lifecycle account management processes. So moving on, our academic data warehouse project. To get a sense of where you are, what's the state of academic analytics on your campus? And when I'm talking about academic analytics, I'm thinking of a repository and capabilities around handling student and faculty data from both administrative and learning management systems, and that this should be supported by a data dictionary, a documented data dictionary, beyond what exists in the transactional source systems, and data governance, so a body to review and approve those data definitions and how analytical models are constructed. It's interesting. So I see that many of us are at option one, where basically institutional research and local units are doing what they need to do based upon extracts from common systems and local data sources in a get or done with what you have kind of approach, with some with a limited use central repository, and just a few with a more comprehensive central repository. So we are in that same place. We are in where most of the rest of you are, in that ad hoc institutional research doing a lot of heavy lifting, local groups doing a lot of heavy lifting with data extracts place. We have a custom-developed student information system that dates back to the 80s, which does not have built-in analytical capabilities. So analysis is done, as we just described, and the weapon of choice is Excel, generally. So there are a lot of local data repositories with segments of data, and we're challenged to perform more than required analysis or one-time analysis, just due to the amount of effort it takes to gather and analyze data. And we know that that limitation can't persist moving forward. As we are increasingly data-driven, we expect our data to become more voluminous and our analytical requirements to become more complex. So we've been working for about a year, and there was certainly preparation prior to the start of this formal schedule, on an academic data warehouse project to establish a robust central repository for both canned and ad hoc reporting and provide more capable and secure reporting tools. So what you see here are the bundles of major activities and scope on our project, in particular a fairly long pilot phase that's associated with admissions and financial aid. And you might notice that the class course graduation, faculty and prospect and inquiry pieces of scope don't have visible bars on the schedule. Well, I can share that originally they did, but our time frame has extended, and I wanted to share that just some of the natures of our challenges here have been really around creating the data dictionaries that didn't exist, definitions of the data models, definitions of calculated fields, development of security model and appropriate use policies, development of our training rollout, in order to provide a much more capable ad hoc reporting capability. A lot of that definitional work, especially for the first set of models in which the person data has to be described, has taken us longer than we had expected, been complex and challenging, but I think a very good investment in the future as we need to add to the scale of that data and understand very well whether data that we are adding to that repository as different types of learners enter our environment is the same or different as what we already have, and what types of longitudinal analysis make sense. Moving on, student systems. So when we talk about different types of student data entering our data warehouse in the future, we're thinking about the future of our administrative systems and wondering what you're thinking as well. So this here, I'm referring to student administrative systems in through the full life cycle. And you may select all that apply here. So looks like there are a number of you discussing new requirements or the lack of capability of current systems. That's really where we are at BU. And we are looking for new solutions and talking to providers and other institutions about what they are doing. So, yeah, interesting to see many of you are in a similar place to where we are, and we're thinking about what some of those emerging requirements are. So what are some of those emerging requirements that we are thinking about? First, mobility and usability first. I've had one of the folks on our team talking about this has said, well, perhaps if it's not mobile, it doesn't matter if you do it because nobody's going to use it. But really thinking about mobility and usability first and where we can, how we can best get there, not necessarily as an add-on in a future state system when we replace our current systems, but we want to get there with that as a default capability and the way that the system is architected and designed. And that really being closely tied to learner centricity with a focus on the student and the faculty experience through the system rather than the administrator experience. Not forgetting, though, that those administrative processes need to be truly efficient to ideally actually save resources to either actually achieve cost savings for the university or enable reallocation to the core mission of teaching and research. I skipped there. Relationship management goes social. That's thinking about not only do we want to have much more robust relationship management capabilities in our future system, but thinking about how social networking technologies and ways of thinking could impact how we think about everything from advising to career networking and placement. We want to be sure that we can accommodate alternative credentials, such as badging or shorter-term degrees or combination degrees between, say, bachelor's and master's programs, flexible delivery models, new and hybrid student types, a person who is enrolled both in a conventional program, in a MOOC, and perhaps in a professional program. Thinking about things like data portability and ease of integration. I'm not sure how many of you may be familiar with the My Data initiative from the Department of Education, which is about enabling the exporting of data to students to maintain their own educational record. That's an interesting initiative from our perspective, and I think it's just one part of the potential increasing mobility of students around institutions. Then thinking about massive scale, I want to be prepared not only on basic things like not having a massive licensing implication at such point as I need to have hundreds of thousands of students in our SIS or have any infrastructure issues at that point, but also analytics, thinking about how we would be able to check if an applicant to a degree program has previously attempted a BU MOOC. And if so, how did they do? The ability to know if a current BU student is enrolled in a BU MOOC, or the ability to provide academic advisors with information regarding BU MOOC enrollment for their BU students, and the ability to identify BU MOOC enrollment by BU alumni. Right now, I think we're at a very early point in thinking about MOOCs, and these repositories of data are separate. And there's a lot of work to be done here. And last, we really want the agility to adapt to what we don't know yet. We have to acknowledge that we don't know what we don't know, but we sure know we don't know it, and that there are things that are going to change, and we need the ability to adapt and innovate. So lastly, digital learning. This is a little bit different poll from Tracy Futhi's poll, a little bit more about not so much what you're doing, whether you're doing MOOCs, but how you're thinking about it in terms of institutional structures or discussion. Let's see. So this is defined broadly as online and hybrid learning for credit or non-credit on conventional or massive scale. So it looks like there are a lot of experiments in progress and some digital learning organizations being formed or already formed, task forces being formed. Looks like the majority, though, are in a combination of experimentation and digital learning or related organizations being formed. And I suppose that's fortunate because that's where we are, too. We're working on getting those experiments going, conducting some of them, and forming an organization to support that. So this is a conceptual diagram of not the technical architecture, but the human architecture, if you will, we're working on to support digital learning. And we're working to translate this kind of conceptual organization into the practical terms of positions, who reports to who, budgets, and keeping in mind flexibility and innovation as guiding principles. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is how you achieve the agility of a startup while avoiding the long-term silos that Tracy Futhi alluded to, and enable that shared leveraging of infrastructure, not only in terms of technical capabilities, but people and their skill sets as well. So one of the things in thinking about the specific role of IT here that's also been interesting is that to a large extent what I've been working on at BU has been strengthening the IT organization as a service provider, and I think we've made a lot of progress there. But in our discussions of the digital learning initiative, it's been clear that what our academic community is looking for, and I think not unreasonably so, is what they see as beyond a service provider, not a client and technology professional dynamic, but a true partnership proposal or true partnership framework where there is full and complete collaboration, less structure, a very agile approach, and I think it is not really absence of a service mentality, but more taking that to the advanced level where some of the most formal structures can fall to the side, but the major components of the interaction are still going to happen. The documentation will happen ultimately, but where the communication back and forth is seamless and happening at a deep level, and the IT organization isn't just taking orders and fulfilling requests, but really contributing to vision. And to Tracy Futhi's point about being at the center of the table, I would say we're at the center of the table, but along with the provost and the academic leadership of the institution in a type of partnership that I think is really critical for this to be successful. And with that, I think I'm ready for questions.
Tracy, I've got several for you, but let me pick up on your discussion about student systems and students and a point that you made a little while ago about new and hybrid student types, and ask the question, if we assume that many of our students are going to be highly mobile, either amongst our own institutions or across their lifetime, the question is, how do you enable the mobility of a student's learning information without some sort of universal ID? So how do we keep track of everybody when they're moving around all the time?
Yeah, you know, I'll give a short answer. I'm not exactly sure how, but I think one of the paradigms that I've been thinking about is the record really residing, the student becomes much more the owner of the record than the institution. And sort of along the lines of the Mozilla Badges project, where you could create a backpack of your badges that you accumulate your credentials in, and you carry your credentials with you in that virtual backpack. And I think the question will be how that backpack evolves for students over this time period said it, I think it will contain, and whether it's Mozilla's or someone else's remains to be seen, but I think it will contain more than badges. I think it will contain the whole student record, but we'll be moving towards a time where the student, the learner, owns their record and is provided with tools, if not by higher education directly, then by third parties, to maintain that record in the same way they might maintain passwords or health records.
And Marcel just asked a question in chat about whether that backpack time should be lifelong.
I think so. I think it has to be, personally.
So another question about students, and it's how do or where do you see the opportunity in overcoming the challenges with true authentication of digital learners? We always wonder, are they who they say they are?
Yeah. Well, I know that I think we all probably know some of the experiments that Coursera and others have been working through around validation patterns, say your typing patterns can indicate that you are you, or webcam-based verification tools to authenticate that you are you. I think over time we're going to see more of those kinds of things and biometric type authentication of digital learners. But in the meantime, there's always the third-party place-based, proctor-based option, for example, edX's partnership with I believe it's Pearson, I'm not sure, but that will do the testing, validated in person in many locations around the world. I think there are a variety of ways of doing it, but the truly digital way of doing it, my guess is that it's going to move into the artificial intelligence biometric realm ultimately. How long that takes, I don't know.
It's one of those things where we know what we don't know, huh?
Yeah.
Great. Well, Tracy, Zenith, thank you.
Iris scans. I would bet yes.
Yes. So thank you very much. Very nice compliment to Tracy Futhi, and appreciate you digging into a lot of these complex issues, and I think you've got a lot of resonance with people. Let me turn it over to Ethan now. To share his perspective, that of a third CIO.
Thank you so much, Diana, and a big thank you to both Tracy Schroeder and Tracy Futhi, who have both given some wonderful insights into the architecture for the connected age and have given me not one but two very hard acts to follow. The good news, of course, is we get to stand on their shoulders and also on the shoulders of everybody who's been busy in the sprint for the last couple of days. So I think we'll find some interesting connections between our three perspectives and hopefully also some interesting differences. So those of us who do this kind of thing for a living are supposed to be building the IT architecture for the connected age, right? And that means we need to predict some things about where the connected age is taking us. But prediction is hard, right? And I joke that I can't even really predict where this talk is going because I, too, am going to offer some polls up and I'll even try to respond to them to the best of my ability. But this outline is what I predict that we're going to spend our next 20 minutes on. I'll ask you for some input about the university for the connected age and the services that it needs. And I'll share a little bit about the perspective from my school, Merrillhurst University, and tell you what we're planning about and what we're working on. And I'd like to end with some observations and questions that I think may be worthy of our attention. So I'm going to start off by asking for your input on a poll, which is to name just one attribute of the university for the connected age. So you're all familiar with the poll box, of course, and just a note that you can type a new answer, but it will replace your previous one. So if you need to say more than one thing, you have to put it on one line. And while you're doing this, I just want to share my belief that I think there are a lot of different kinds of universities that are likely to exist in the connected age, just as there are now. So I think there are a lot of right answers to this question. And I'm seeing some wonderful ones. Culturally agile, learner-centric is going to come up. Collaborative and flexible, responsive and global. Wow, these are wonderful. Thank you. Great. So now I want to ask you to actually, I've only got two polls for you, and I've put them back to back. And so the second one is to build on this, and by all means, choose the attribute that you talked about, or choose another one if it appeals to you, and think about what services we need to provide in order to support those attributes. So these are the things that our architecture needs to support, and those could be anything from, you know, connectivity to pervasive coffee, whatever the university needs. So again, agility. So our services are going to be things like, oh, data dashboards, a holodeck. I like that one. Thank you. Anywhere access, anytime access. These are great answers. Mobility, all. Okay, that may be my favorite answer so far. So we're going to come back to some of these in a moment. And, oh, high-def video, I like that too. But I want to just mention the fact that there's a wonderful law called Miles' Law that I love that says where you stand depends upon where you sit. And so I just want to make it clear where I sit, and that will give you a framework for how to make sense of what I'm going to share with you. So I personally have been in private nonprofit higher ed for my whole career, and I now work at a small regional adult-focused liberal university, Merrill Hurst University. We are 120 years old. We were founded with a view of education as an issue of social justice and a strong drive to serve the underserved, and we still carry those with us. We started catering to what is now called the post-traditional student back in 1974 when we went non-residential and turned our attention to serving adults. So we're about half online. We're about half graduate. And our students include many part-time working adults. We make very heavy use of adjunct faculty, which we believe is a strength. Many of our adjuncts are professionals who are working in the fields that they teach. And so that provides a connection between theory and practice that we believe enriches a Merrill Hurst education. Like many non-selective institutions, we're also tuition-driven, and we have a very modest endowment, so every dollar counts. We are, of course, not massive. We're also not interested in becoming massive. We believe that there is a kind of education that works best at small scale. And a challenge for us, and it's a huge challenge, is to discern which educational needs are going to be best met efficiently at large scale. These are interesting places, and there are many of them, but they're also places where we are going to be outcompeted because that's not our niche. And discern those from the ones that are best served at a small scale, which is where we have our core strengths. And then we need to adapt our offerings to focus on the places where we add unique value. Another way of saying this is that we need to react to the unbundling of education. There was a note in the chat earlier during, I believe it was Tracy Schroeder's presentation, saying that students were looking for more interaction in order to connect theory and practice. This may be something that happens well at small scale. So in saying where I stand and sharing this information with you, what I'm trying to do is identify how my university creates value and to point out that every enterprise needs to build architecture to create value. So our mission, our vision, and our business position drive our strategy. Our strategy drives our architecture. And I've tried to make that connection transparent by distilling it into a few principles, hopefully very simple principles. And this is really the heart of the way that we think about architecture. The first and most important principle is to support the self-directed learner. So we can't take it for granted that our learners arrive with all of the tools that they need to successfully take charge of their own education. But since our objective is liberal education, that's our job, to ensure that they acquire these capacities of being lifelong self-directed learners. Now, these are also exactly the capacities that people need in order to thrive in a connected age, which is why I would argue that liberal education is increasingly important. There's a conclusion that you can draw from this, which I happen to believe, which is that once a student is sufficiently developed as a self-directed learner, our job, essentially at the undergraduate level, is essentially done. And they should graduate and move on. There's another thing to note, which is that these are exactly the same skills that a learner needs in order to benefit from a MOOC, which is consistent with the data that a high fraction of MOOC attendees already have a degree. And I want to give a special shout-out and a word of thanks to Colleen Keller, who is busy posting related links in the chat to some background information that just supports and extends on what I'm mentioning very briefly. So thank you, Colleen. I also on this slide refer to the concept of heudagogy, which is an emerging field of study. It's distinct from pedagogy or andragogy, and it deals specifically with the development of the learner as self-directed. Worth a look if you haven't come across it yet. The second principle may seem a little abstract at first, which is to make learning visible wherever it happens. This is the work of assessment, writ large, I would say. And it's important because most of the learning, certainly much, and I would say most of the learning, happens outside of class. And I think that's true anywhere, but it's particularly true in serving adults and non-residential working adults. There's a kind of magic that you get outside of the classroom when you have a residential experience. As a non-residential place, we need to go out of our way to help our learners identify, reflect upon, and share their learning. So this is a critical and technology-supported activity. And it's one we can do, I believe, with pretty cheap technology. We'll get back to talking about the specifics in a moment. But it involves a big change in our thinking and our practice. And it's important to us as technologists because how we engage with faculty and with assessment have a huge impact on it. The third principle seems kind of like a no-brainer, right, to learn from consumerization, what I call bring your own whatever, or BYOX. And X could be a device, but it could be an app, it could be a service, it could be something completely different. And obviously, in this group, I don't need to point out that the paradigm shift is not about who owns the device or the intellectual property, but the paradigm shift is about getting to use your own tools, which is something any skilled worker wants to do. Most of us want to control our tools. And the lesson is really one about trust and mastery and autonomy. So that's the principle that we take from that one. Powering connections is painfully obvious when you think about designing an IT architecture for the connected age, but it's not always something we've been terribly good at in the past. In many LMSs, including the one that we are using right now, a student who's in two classes at the same time, possibly with the same peers or teacher, would experience those as two very different disconnected environments. So in that situation, you could argue that even connecting a person with themselves is hard, and we're not doing it very well. So what we need to do is power connections to go much farther than the class, both across the social network and also across time. That last bullet on delivering value is very simple. Every dollar we spend pretty much comes out of our students' pockets. I don't need to explain to this group how important that is for every kind of institution, particularly today. But it's also particularly important for an institution like Merrillhurst, with our values around education as an issue of social justice. Affordability and accessibility are critical to us. So rather than go into the technical details of the IT architecture, what I want to do is talk about some decisions and how we can approach decisions about where to invest. And one model for that is what should we own and what should we avoid owning. So I'll reiterate some of what Tracy said about the importance of identity and access management and security, and she covered this way better than I can, so I'm not going to say anything more about it. The back office system, of course, for efficiency and effectiveness, but also to get to state-of-the-art. And at Merrill Hurst, for example, we're moving to state-of-the-art CRM and Salesforce to complement our existing ERP so that we can bring user-facing tools to absolute world-class with a minimum of our own engineering, because they're easier to buy than they are to build. We start to get interesting when we talk about supporting a simple, powerful general tool set. And this is pretty idealistic. And when I say this, I'm talking about almost all of our learning technology. So that may range from the LMS to blogs and file repositories and video conferencing and the whole thing. It's a very idealistic goal. And it's more of an aspiration than a plan. And I don't for a minute really believe that we can foist a single tool set on everyone at a university. But it's a reasonable way to target our investment. And here's why. As we're moving towards this diverse environment of bring your own whatever, one of the risks and the costs that comes with it is that we bring a proliferating array of technology. And in the end, having everyone optimize for their individual preferences and their individual needs tends to make it harder to collaborate. So the cost of the diversity can easily outweigh the benefit. So it's our job to help people onto simple, powerful, interoperable platforms, not necessarily one platform, but things that work together well. But we have to finesse this, right? And we have to do it without going the old school way, which might have been to impose a university-owned, licensed, controlled, walled space, right? Because you can easily standardize if you own it and you inflict it on people. It's harder to standardize when you don't. And we need to do it while promoting self-efficacy, people's ability to take charge of their own technological environment and their own learning. So at Merrill Hurst, we're on Google Apps, for example, as a part of this. And it has its challenges, but it actually does a lot. We haven't exhausted its potential yet. We'll come back to some of the things that we can do with it. We're also working on state-of-the-art pervasive video conferencing. Right now, we have a site license for a well-known video conferencing tool, but it's so hard to use that adoption is very low. So we're looking at replacing that with emerging technology, which is much, much easier to use and has a much lower threshold for involvement, because it should be as easy as email or text or whatever. We're also designing a new information commons that will serve as a hub for connecting learners not just in that space, but also across space and across time. Our learners are scattered in both of those dimensions. And we're trying to make every one of those initiatives serve as many purposes as possible to save on both money and on complexity. So the last bullet about passion and expertise for teaching and learning, I know I'm preaching to the choir with this bunch, but it's important to say it, and I've been so pleased to hear the many statements about being at the table. So I think we've earned that spot at the table by showing up with genuine knowledge and genuine curiosity about education, not just about technology, and by showing up with that background and by staying constant collaborators and constant learners, we get to shape the conversation in new ways. And since there's been so much said about that, I don't feel the need to say more. The articles that Colleen just posted from Audrey Waters, Hacked Education, are definitely worth a read if you haven't seen them already. So what should other people own? Now I'm going to leave the trail a little bit. I like to talk about the post-LMS world. I am going to go out on a limb and say that the LMS strikes me as being fundamentally incompatible with the architecture that we need for the connected age. The metaphor just feels wrong to me. So this is true of any LMS. And there's certainly some valiant experiments going on how to bridge openness and management. And it's not a simple problem. We have a genuine first-class dilemma. On the one hand, we all know that the connected age doesn't work by managing the system. It works by enabling connections in ways that are fundamentally open, uncontrolled, and unpredictable, right? The heart of the connected age is individuals determining their own destiny by connecting, learning, and co-creating directly without intermediaries. To be on the right side of history, we need to find ways to help the learners own the entire process. It's enough. And I'm going to talk a lot more about what learner owned, and I think the answer to that has to be that we're heading towards everything. But there's another horn to the dilemma, which is that we're not there yet, and we can't get there in one step, and we can't get there with blind idealism. So as a university today, we need to manage the system. We're packaging it, we're selling it, and we're accountable for it. So our challenge is to be on the right side of both history and also the present. And that means helping our institutions to find paths into the future, which is much, much harder than just ranting about it. So at Merrillhurst, we're taking incremental steps to increase student ownership of their learning artifacts and their assessment. I told you we'd get back to Google Apps, for example. So it turns out you can make an adequate and possibly quite good learner-owned e-portfolio system with Google Apps. So e-portfolios, I hear people going eek in the background, they are so last week or last year or last decade in some ways, but I think in concept that's not true because the core of the connected age makes it up to each learner to identify, reflect upon, and share their own learning wherever it comes from. So we've talked about badges, and they're nice, right? And they or something like them are surely going to be part of the future. But direct evidence of learning and achievement, I think, will always rule. And it'll rule because it's necessary for the learning itself. It's necessary for making meaning of learning the way that it happens in the connected age. So this isn't just or even mostly classroom learning and things that you can necessarily convey particularly well with testing. Direct, fundamental, formative assessment is intimately connected to concurrent learning, prior learning, experiential learning, service learning. These are the kinds of learning that are going to be exploding thanks to the connected age. I want to just note that the domain of your own project has come up in the chat, and that I love that project. I think it's heading in a wonderful direction, and there are great questions as how we make that even better into something where owning your own learning, as I said, soup to nuts, becomes easy for everyone to do. And so I think the domain of your own is exactly a step to address this issue of tools that around assessment that impose practices. So the learning and the assessment in the connected age are going to be learner-owned. We don't really have any choice in that. But our job is to figure out how to support it. So we have to relinquish control without giving up our value as institutions. And I, for one, honestly believe that it will actually help us focus on our value because it will help us drop the relatively trivial record-keeping part. And I want to throw out something about MOOCs here. So the sprint, of course, is titled Beyond MOOCs, which is great. But we still need to make sense of the MOOC phenomenon. And I would like you to consider the idea that what MOOCs are doing is solving the easiest problems that we have in education. That's good, right? There is nothing wrong with starting with the easiest problems. It's exactly the way that we should start, right? We should work up from easier things to harder things. But it's important that we remember that there are hard, unsolved problems out there. And so I said I would end with some questions. And I want to draw attention to a hard and false problem and a question. And it's a very simple question, but I think it's one that we ignore at our peril. And that question is, who are we missing? So this very beautiful image was created in 2010 by Paul Butler, who was then an intern at Facebook. And what he did is he mapped the connections between Facebook friends on the globe. And, you know, the first map was ugly, and as he tweaked the parameters, turning it into this beautiful image that looks like it was, you know, painted on the night sky with light. It's gorgeous. He wrote that the blob turned into a surprisingly detailed map of the world. And, of course, that is what you see when you first look at it. But what are we missing? So this is a National Geographic map of the world where wealth is coded by color. Blue is wealthy, and population density is coded by brightness, right? So the bright blue parts show up really well on the Facebook map, but there are some bright parts that are in yellow or pink that don't show up so well on the Facebook map. We're going back to it. I'm going to jump back to the National Geographic map, and then I thought, that's odd. It looks like we're missing a lot of stuff. So I went up to World Mapper, a delightful service, and I threw up a couple of other options, and these are our three maps from World Mapper that show some of the parts that are missing. And by the way, you'll notice that parts of Africa, Central and South America are missing on the Facebook map, right? So the World Mapper translates other attributes into the size of a country, and I put up three: land area, population, and wealth. And the difference between these maps that we're seeing shows a little glimpse into who's connected on that Facebook map, who's included and who isn't. None of these provide the answer, and I don't know exactly what the message is. But I think it's a call to look more closely, and by closely I mean both figuratively, we need to study it more closely, and also literally we need to look closer to home. And I'd like to connect this to home in another way. So just yesterday, a report came out from Georgetown University, Separate but Unequal, describing how the American education system reinforces racial inequality in the United States. We have work to do. I want to be clear that I'm very bullish on technology and education, and I'm very excited about the possibilities offered by the connected age, or if not, my job would be a terrible fit for me. I really believe that technology is a powerful tool that we can use to build society the way we want, but I also want to keep our targets in mind and to go back and keep testing our performance against reality. So you're doing good work, and we still have a long way to go. So thank you so much, and we can take it to questions.
Okay. Thanks, Ethan. What I'd like to do is ask all three of you to jump into the conversation. And there's, I think, a tension around us developing a lot of these tools and applications and the infrastructure individually and encouraging sort of a common tool set, a collaborative model. And, of course, it's easier to say that than to actually do it. So I guess I'd like for you all, if you care to comment on whether institutions should address these challenges individually or whether there's a realistic way to organize it and do it together. Anyone care to comment?
Tracy Fusi, I'll jump in to get the conversation started. I think you're right, and the question that came from the participant is absolutely right on. We waste an incredible amount of collective energy in solving the problem many times and multiple times. I think there are two forces that go against what would otherwise seem to be the rational approach of let's do it all together. I think one of those is we still tend to be campuses that believe, you know, we've got to solve it our own way or do it our own way for our own population. And I think historically that has been the biggest impediment to more common solutions, although we have managed to work out some, whether it's some of the identity management approaches or otherwise. We've often let ourselves get divided by the presumption that people have to do things in the easy way, the way they always have, and there's no possible way that we can solve it in the same way on two campuses. So that's one thought. The other thing, though, I think that's a force against it is maybe a little bit different for us in the IT domain than historically has been the case. I think IT has been one of these places in higher ed where there has been fantastic collaboration, a great level of willingness to share information, insights, and even solutions. One of us does it, we almost take pride in, sure, go ahead and use it, right? And that's, I think, a little bit different in the IT domain of higher ed, even than some of our other parts of higher ed, where maybe there's more of a sense of competition. Nobody's going to choose one of our universities over the other because it has a better student information system, although they'll certainly care dearly about whether they have online registration or not, is it mobile or not. But that's rarely the discerning point. I do think, as we think about the common tools and solutions to some of these other online learning and other challenges, we get into a different world and almost at odds potentially with our faculty, who in many ways see their own unique approach as being as needing to be protected and perhaps separate from others. And if why is my course different from somebody else's course of the same title? So I think we can use common tools. I would love it if we could get to the point that we could use common course components and materials and trade and mix and match those not only within our institution but at a high level, right, open approaches in higher ed. But that one I think will be harder for us as an industry, so to speak.
And Marcel had noted that getting together and choosing one system together are two different things. So Tracy, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. I agree with a lot of the factors that Tracy has identified there. At the same time, I do think that this time that the forces of resource scarcity and the drive for significant cost efficiency will drive greater consortial activity on the administrative systems and infrastructure fronts. I think we will see more adoption of common solutions, more aggregation of buying power, and more consortial activity. And on the MOOC front or the online education front, I do think that there is also some energy around consortia that provide good company and brand affiliation and shared expertise and risk mitigation in this time of experimentation, so that we see consortia like edX building or other groupings of like institutions, or at least institutions that have some form of historical affinity, talking about these kinds of consortia. And granted, not all institutions will do it, but I think we will see more aggregation on both of those infrastructure and support service fronts from the standpoint of efficiency and from the learning front from the point of shared experience, shared innovation, and good company.
Excellent. Ethan, if you have a 30-second comment, please go ahead and chime in.
Sure. I think Tracy, pick one, hit it right on the head. But I will add that the scarcity of resources and the competition is driving not just the administration but academics to respond by focusing on where we are individually distinctive. And that means that places where we're not individually distinctive, we're going to have to settle for commodity. And so I think that the economics are doing us a favor by driving us in that direction.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'm afraid we are already out of time. So let me share just a few points that really struck me as we went through today's session. Tracy Futhi started out with location, 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 but the location is beyond the campus as the epicenter. Tracy Schroeder taught us to think about mobility and usability first, talked about new and hybrid student types and supporting the self-directed learner. Ethan then raised the question, if we are supporting those learners, then what do we own and what do we help others own. We have the notion of student-owned data and a backpack. And then Ethan pushed us a little bit farther, talking about the connected age and not working by controlling things, but that learners really need to own their own artifacts, learning, and so on, and ask the question about how we support it. And then I go back to what Tracy Schroeder said, that it's all about the ability to adapt to what you don't yet know. So there's lots that we don't yet know, but I think after the last 3 days, there's a whole lot more we do, and a convergence of a number of different ideas. So Tracy, and Ethan, thank you so much for joining us today. I think it's been an absolutely wonderful conversation. And thank you to all of you who have joined us from around the globe for this conversation. Before you sign off, if you would take a moment to click on the evaluation link in the lower right-hand corner, your opinion does matter to us. And again, the session will be archived on the EDUCAUSE Sprint website. It will include the slides, a webinar recording, as well as those wonderful visual notes. And tomorrow, as a wrap-up, you'll receive a summary newsletter, and again, we'll be asking for your comments to improve future events. So if you've got a bit more time, we hope you'll join us on IdeaScale, which is our conversation hub for the sprint and afterwards, and you can access IdeaScale from the link you see on your screen. But, of course, the conversation doesn't end here. I hope you will look for the September-October issue of EDUCAUSE Review, because it will have lots of articles and case studies on connected learning, along with future EDUCAUSE Live webinars, and, of course, the EDUCAUSE annual conference, where you'll hear a number of these topics explored as well. And the dates for the annual conference are October 15 to 18 in Anaheim, California. So thank you for joining us for the EDUCAUSE Sprint. It's a production of EDUCAUSE, the Higher Education Technology Association. This is Diana Oblinger. Thanks for joining us for the Sprint.